Welcome. You are at session 131, The Mormons, a film by Helen Whitney. My name is Laura Bush. I'm a lecturer at Arizona State University and a member of the Sunstone Board of Directors. And I'd like to ask any of you who might have anything that might make odd sounds at any moment to please turn those off. Moderate, remember. And also, because this is a panel and we want to really have a lively discussion after the panel, please remember to come to the microphone here so that it's on the recording. I'd also like to acknowledge that Helen Whitney is in the audience, and we hope for a few comments from her. We assume that she may have some comments, but this is really a discussion about the film from our perspective, and we're happy to have her here as well. So I'll get on to explaining who our panelists are. They're all going to take approximately 10 to 12 minutes of time. Our first panelist is Dr. Lawrence Foster. He's a professor of American history at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. He specializes in American religious and social history, with strong interests in modern European and comparative history as well. His most recent research has focused on changes in American family patterns and sex roles, the social impact of new and controversial religious movements, or cults, and the dynamics of mass movements and political revolutions. He's published more than 40 articles and 3 books, primarily on the celibate Shakers, Free Love, Oneida Community, and polygamous Mormons in 19th century America. I used his work when I was doing my own research on my own book. He served as president of the Communal Studies Association and the Mormon History Association, although he's not a Mormon. Our second presenter is Anne Porter, who's a software developer from Slidell, Louisiana. She's a convert of 20 plus years. She joined the church in Ohio during the big boom of the mid-80s. The first non-correlated book that she read about Mormons was Dr. Foster's Religion and Sexuality, and she says it was a real eye-opener. She was just a little disappointed that it didn't contain more sex. Right, and our final presenter is David Pace. Get to my notes. I know who you are, but I want to get this straight. A fiction writer and essayist. He won first place in the 2004 Utah Original Writing Contest for his novel titled Where Empty Armor Comes to Rest, and first place in the 2005 Writers at Work Creative Nonfiction Fellowship Competition. His byline has appeared, among other publications, in the Christian Science Monitor, American Theater, and Salt Lake Magazine. He currently is serving as book reviews editor for Eriantum, the Journal of the Association for Mormon Letters. He is also currently working as the Director of Development at Riley Woodbury Dance Company. I also want to mention that Seth Perry was going to be in the panel, but his wife has gotten quite ill and he had to return to Chicago, and I hope we'll all keep him in our thoughts and send energy that way. All right? So he would have been a great, I've heard Seth speak at different points, and he's a non-Mormon doing Mormon studies, and we regret that he cannot be here. So, Larry, it's your turn.
Just testing, yes. Okay, good. All right. After Helen Whitney's extraordinary and moving presentation yesterday evening, I feel I must preface my remarks this morning by reminding you of a classic Peanuts strip. In it, Linus and Charlie Brown are lying on their backs on a grassy hill looking up at the clouds. Linus is saying to Charlie Brown, "Aren't clouds fascinating? You can see so many different things in them. Why, over there I see the stoning of Stephen, and on that side is King John signing the Magna Carta, and over in the distance is Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo. What do you see in the clouds, Charlie Brown?" And Charlie Brown replies, "Well, I was going to say that I saw a doggy and a kitty and a fishy, but I think I just changed my mind. After last night, I think I may not have a whole lot more that really needs to be said, but let me have a go at it, as they say." Okay, I've increasingly become convinced that anyone who hopes to comprehend the complex and highly ambivalent character and impact of Mormonism's founding prophet, Joseph Smith, would almost have to be, in some degree at least, as complex and remarkable as he himself was. Ultimately, I don't believe that the greater can ever be adequately understood in terms of the lesser. Beyond that, however, even if we had such individual with requisite depth, it's not clear that they could solve the prophet puzzle either, since it appears that Joseph himself may never have fully understood himself and his goals fully. In what one of Joseph Smith's astute yet controversial biographers, Fawn McCabe Brody, took to be a challenge thrown out to his future biographers, but which seems to me better understood as an expression of the utmost loneliness and pathos, Joseph declared publicly only months before his assassination, "You never knew my heart. No man knows my history. I cannot tell it. I shall never understand it. If I had not experienced what I have, I would not have known it myself." Beyond the challenge, the obvious and extraordinary challenge posed by Joseph Smith himself in trying to come to terms with him, there's an even more daunting challenge, of course, and that's trying to interpret his lengthened shadow in the movement, the larger religious movement he inspired, which has now impacted the lives of millions of men and women in this country and throughout the world. That interpretive challenge, I think, is suggested by the well-known story of the six men of Hindustan to learning much inclined who went to see the elephant, though each of them were blind. As you know, each of these blind men took hold of part of the elephant and concluded that erroneously that they had the entire beast. And I think that anyone who is going to approach an event that's big enough and important enough is going to find that there will be different perspectives, contradictory perspectives, because any really important group, idea, or event impacts different people differently, inevitably. And so, for some people, one person's truth can be another's error, and radically different conclusions can be reached from the same material. The task facing Helen Whitney, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, and her able associates who produced The Mormons thus was, I think, extraordinarily daunting. Maybe not quite as great as Joseph Smith trying to wrap all previous human truth together in one package in preparing for the millennium, but still, nevertheless, quite daunting. And also that it was not simply verbal, but that it also had to have the visual portrayal of extremely complex people, movements, ideas to make it hold together. There's such a gap between believers in the Restoration who believe that they've found the one true faith necessary for eternal salvation, and the critics who've over the years excoriated Mormonism or dismissed it more often without even looking at it seriously as a sort of preposterous con job with bizarre and dangerous beliefs that really is better. I don't know exactly what they propose to do about it, but in any case. The question is there a basis for common ground? How can this be achieved? To what extent does the Mormons, the documentary, succeed in bridging this extraordinarily difficult and important gap? Just based on informal conversations and polling, very unscientific sampling, with Mormon and non-Mormon people who have viewed the documentary, it seems to me that there's good evidence that the documentary succeeds in at least, and quite well, I should say, in at least one of its primary objectives, namely to help viewers from different persuasions break out of old interpretive ruts and at least to realize that there might be something more to the elephant than what they've already taken it to encompass. Mormons, on the one hand, I think, tending to be quite favorable, at least in public, have also been very uncomfortable with what they see, in some cases, as Whitney's overemphasis on the dark side of the Mormon experience, especially in sections such as dealing with controversial topics such as polygamy, mountain meadows, and the pressures on Mormon dissidents and intellectuals, ironically, the sections that I found in some ways the most powerful. Conversely, on the other hand, non-Mormons have also commented very favorably in a number of ways, but and have, I think, appreciated the remarkable the characters and the sincerity and the complexity of the commitment of the people that they've been watching, while at the same time they've continued to feel that the Mormons as a whole are still a little rude, and maybe the producer pulled a few too many punches, especially in dealing with controversial topics of religious origins and truth claims. I think the mix that I've gotten so far suggests that there's something here that is worth attention from both sides. I would like to just highlight a marvelous review, I think maybe the best I've seen of this film. If anyone hasn't seen the latest issue of Sunstone, the June 2007 issue, it has a wonderful essay by Matthew Bowman on this, and I just want to summarize his argument and then see if I can go a little bit beyond it in the time that I have remaining. Bowman thinks that Whitney is most fascinated by the unresolved paradoxes she sees in Mormonism, and that she in fact revels in and delights in those paradoxes and deliberately presents contradictory perspectives without seeking to fully resolve those for her viewers. He praises the work as a triumph artistically and sees the heart of Whitney's understanding of Mormonism as resting in her attraction to its mysteries, the nature of spiritual experience, how it is attained, and what it bestows. He concludes that Mormonism embodies traits that, in his words, to quote him, continue to make Mormonism an enigma to many Americans. If that is what intrigues Helen Whitney about the Mormons, it may be that the Mormons prefer it that way. Well, Bowman clearly has identified, I think, important ways of looking at the Mormons, and I'm really sorry he wasn't able to be here because of an alternate commitment that he couldn't get out of. I also believe that Helen Whitney, as she pointed out also last night, has a much broader objective than simply showing the flip side of every issue and sort of letting the chips fall where they may. At the risk of sort of revealing the extent of my inability to touch more than a tiny segment of the elephant's anatomy with the Mormon elephant or Helen Whitney's portrayal of it, let me just mention two brief examples, one almost obvious and maybe the two are both obvious, and then make a concluding comment. The first and most obvious of the questions that I think runs through the whole film, clearly runs through the whole film from beginning to end, is the $64 question, or maybe something a little bit higher than that at this stage. How could it be that a group that in the 19th century was so hated and so reviled by non-Mormons, and I hate to say it, but there were reasons, it wasn't entirely that they were just nasty people, how could that have been gradually transformed, increasingly overcome, especially since the so-called great transformation of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, to a much more positive and remarkably more positive in comparison, at least, perspective. And what does that all mean for the future of Mormonism? How is Mormonism in the future going to hold its contradictions, its valuable alternative perspectives in a creative tension without going too far in one way? What's the future? Well, no one can say that, of course, what the future is, except unless you're a prophet, but she eschews that role, I guess. The second point that I think, for me at least, runs through the film, and there are many others, but the issue of commitment. How much commitment is desirable? How much control, how much dedication, how much sacrifice is enough, and how much is too much? What are the costs of great commitment as well as its benefits? Can religious commitment become too great and ultimately have tragic results, most dramatically at Mountain Meadows, but in so many other ways in individual lives and in group experiences as well? On the other hand, you don't want a group to lose its focus, to become diffused, to become no longer truly distinctive and able to contribute. How much time do I have? I'll get through, I think. So how do you balance that? And how do you balance then these concerns for authority and control and individual creativity and free agency and religious exploration that are so also very dynamic and appealing in Mormonism? Thank you. All right, I'll be done. To me, going on from that point, the most poignant and compelling portions of this entire documentary relate to a portrayal of the challenges that thoughtful Mormon dissidents such as Margaret Toscano face and have faced. I think it's not probably coincidental that she chose to show that segment of her film to the Mormon History Association when she presented to that group earlier this year. And it is, it's a difficult section to watch, whether you're Mormon or non-Mormon, for perhaps slightly different reasons. I think some Mormons watching that episode have tried to sort of sidestep the fundamental issues, to focus on little things. Is it legitimate to dramatize the 12 seats and one facing it, the 12, 16, whatever it was, accusers and one facing, and so forth. After I saw that, I was thoroughly, had my thorough discussions with three different knowledgeable independent Mormons who claimed that it was factually inaccurate that the such hearings always had people assigned to both sides, splitting, so it wasn't just one prosecutor, the whole group against prosecuting one person. But just like sometimes we don't know what's happening in our own backyard, apparently it was not true in this case. Margaret was alone and did face the group as a whole. And these are very complex and difficult cases, and there are perfectly good reasons why groups have to maintain boundaries, and yet one sometimes wonders if more couldn't be done. Well, let me conclude by referencing a story that I find very useful in thinking about these sorts of issues. It's from the early 20th century, investigative journalist, outrageous and colorful journalist named Lincoln Steffens, and he told the story as follows. Satan and I were walking down Fifth Avenue in New York City together when we saw a man stop suddenly and pick a piece of truth out of the sky. Right out of the sky, a piece of living truth. Did you see that? I asked Satan. Yes, said Satan. Well, doesn't it worry you? Don't you know that it's enough to destroy you and all you stand for? Oh, yes, but I'm not worried. I'll tell you why. It's a beautiful living thing now, but the man will first name it, and then he will organize it, and by that time, it will be dead. If he would let it live and live it, it would destroy me, but I'm not worried. Now, I concluded from that, and a little bit of a peroration and account of my own interest in Mormonism and how it's developed, Joseph Smith picked a piece of truth out of the sky, a piece of living truth. It was powerful, immensely powerful. Sometimes even he couldn't understand what he had in his hand. It was fearful, even to him. His followers wanted truth simplified. Some of them eventually helped kill him because they couldn't comprehend his truth and because some of his very human weaknesses got in the way of his prophetic role. In a sermon several months before his death, as you all know, already referred to his statement about no one knowing his heart and knowing his history, it is so powerful and so full of pathos. The truth that Joseph Smith saw, I think, is still powerful, though largely hidden even from faithful Latter-day Saints. If anyone has helped us to come closer to seeking and reflecting on that elusive truth, I think we owe a lot to Helen Whitney for her, I think, not without flaw, but still very remarkable documentary. Thank you.
Hello. Hello. I wanted to share with you a little bit of my experiences with watching the film, and then after watching the film, reading about other people watching the film, and my responses to what those other people said. I watched the film when it was first released with my husband. We're both Latter-day Saints. We had been looking forward to it for quite some time. We had to wrestle the TV away from the little boy, and that was an adventure. I should just speak for myself. I loved the film. I loved the film. I thought that it was balanced, that it didn't pull any punches, but it did a wonderful job of addressing positives and negatives in a very succinct way, and I know that's a strange word to use with a four-hour film, but it really was. She couldn't have made it any shorter, and I really do wish it had been another night. When after it was over, you know, we both jumped on the internet, because that's what we do, and started looking at some of the responses to it, and I was personally a little taken aback by some of the criticisms I heard of the film from other Latter-day Saints, which maybe I'm not in the same kind of mindset as my brothers and sisters, but there were some criticisms that were addressed, that were brought up, that I did want to bring up and talk about what I think caused those criticisms and then what my response to them was. The first one that I heard was something that came very, very early in the film, and that was the use of the term Alpha and Omega to describe Joseph Smith, that Joseph Smith was the Alpha and Omega of the LDS faith. And that, almost without exception, drove Latter-day Saints nuts, because the Alpha and Omega of our religion is Jesus Christ. It's not Joseph Smith, and everybody who knows anything about Latter-day Saints knows that we don't worship Joseph Smith, we worship Jesus Christ, And that's actually a criticism that, while I can kind of understand, because Alpha and Omega is, I think, a fairly loaded term. It has a scriptural basis, and it's used to describe Jesus in Scripture. And to take that term and move it to Joseph Smith is something that, especially when you're constantly hearing, like, you're not Christians, to hear that ascribed to Joseph Smith is just very frustrating to some Latter-day Saints. However, I happen to think that, especially given what Dr. Foster described as the lengthening shadow of Joseph Smith over our theology, that it actually is a fairly accurate term. Without Joseph Smith, there would be no Latter-day Saints. And the role of Joseph Smith, the view of Joseph Smith, is actually expanding in our church, even as we try to turn our emphasis more from the peculiar Intermountain West cultural identity toward a more mainstream Christian overview. Even as that happens, the vision and scope of Joseph Smith's influence continues to grow. So in that sense, I really do think it's a fairly accurate term. One of the other criticisms I've heard was the amount of time given to the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Like, you're going to be able to describe something as difficult and tragic as Mountain Meadows in 5 minutes. That's a criticism that I just really don't buy at all. It's a very complex story, and I thought that the film did a wonderful job of showing a good balance of the historical context, the criticisms that are leveled by modern critical or non-LDS historians, and at the same time, the more apologetic responses that are offered in response to what was a real tragedy. And I'm going to go ahead and blend in one of my personal favorite pieces of the documentary was at the end, when Dallin Oaks comes closer than I had ever heard a senior member of the LDS Quorum of the 12 Apostles apologizing for what happened. That, I mean, that particular moment almost brought tears to my eyes, because to the contrary, in the past, when President Hinckley spoke at the dedication of the memorial, it's my understanding that he said, well, you know, and, you know, we don't want to give you any impression by what we're saying that we have any responsibility for what happened here. And what Elder Oaks said in that film struck me just very much as the closest thing we have ever yet received to an apology, and I thought that that was very moving. Another criticism, and this one was the funniest, was that the participants weren't labeled. And this is one that that I've read in some of her responses to this, that Helen has said that was deliberate. I did that on purpose because I didn't want people to pigeonhole people based on who they were with what they said. But, you know, Mormons were loose for that. How do we know what to think unless we know who you are? And the funniest response, I'm sharing an anecdote that I just heard third hand, you know, heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend, that there was a criticism leveled about, and why are they having that? Who was he? Just a professor of Islamic studies, tell all these anti-Mormon lies about Joseph Smith and the hat and the hat. And here, this is one of the most prominent apologists for LDS for LDS teachings, but because he didn't have prominent Mormon apologists underneath what he said, he could just be dismissed as, oh, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. I personally enjoyed trying to figure out where people were on the spectrum, because, you know, even though I say, oh, well, what do Mormons know? How do we know what to think unless we know who you are? If you don't know who they are, it's really fun to try to figure out where they are if you don't know, and I'm sorry that some people missed the fun of that part of the film. I do want to talk about a couple more of my personal favorite pieces of this, and I hope that this doesn't sound like I'm sucking up Helen, but I loved the dance sequence. I just loved it. And, you know, I read so many things from people who were like, what was that about? But I just thought it was wonderful between Carol Givens' prose, which was just, I mean, it was positively lyrical, the way he phrased it, and the visual images that went with it. You know, I don't know how well it went with that particular theme that you were trying to get through about pioneers, but it was art, and I'm not a film critic by any stretch of the imagination, and I don't know much about art, but I know it when I see it, and that was art, and I loved that piece of the film for just that reason. It was beautiful to look at. The second thing, and I've already mentioned this, was the Dallin Oaks apology, but I want to come back to it again. When you're taking a look at the LDS Church from a somewhat liberal perspective, it's very easy to sometimes just dismiss the leadership as clueless, out of touch old guys. No, did I say that? No. I personally sometimes have trouble giving members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and the leadership of the church the benefit of the doubt when they say things, because I think it's heavily filtered. I think that they're not being forthright always, that they're saying what they feel that they ought to say. You alluded to this last night, and you stated it very specifically last night, that the higher you get in the hierarchy, the more filtered and opaque your conversation is. That was one of the most transparent moments in the film for me. It seemed to me like a moment of real dismay and grief, and I don't think Dallin Oaks is that good an actor, and I really enjoyed that piece of the film. That was really positive for me. The third thing that really struck me was what I took as an admission by Marlon Jensen, that what we ask of homosexual members of the church is not the same as what we ask of single members of the church. That it is that, and that's an argument that you often hear among Latter-day Saints, that you are not that we don't ask any more from our gay brothers and sisters than we do from our single brothers and sisters. And I have always felt that that's not true, that what we're asking of them is not just to forego intimacy, but to forego hope of meaningful intimacy in this lifetime. And to hear that from a leader of the church in such a high position actually gave me a great deal of hope for our future. Maybe that hope is misplaced, but that recognition is there, I think, is a huge step forward. The fourth piece of the documentary that was the most positive was also the most personal for me. I'm from Slidell, Louisiana. The Bishop's Storehouse for the Gulf Coast is about a mile and a half from my house. And the Hurricane Katrina issue, the Hurricane Katrina segment, which, by the way, should be a documentary all in and of all by itself if you've got another, don't have any other projects on the books, it was extraordinarily moving, and I thought did a wonderful job of condensing not only what the church accomplished, but the response by the community into a small piece of film. The gentleman who said that these people have a place in my home now, they can come to my door and I will let them in, I will offer them a drink of water, they can sit, they can visit, because they're part of my family now, is an absolutely accurate representation of the goodwill that exists toward the church in the Gulf Coast now because of their superb response to the disaster of Hurricane Katrina. And thank you all for your time.
I'd like to thank Dr. Foster and Anne for their comments. I thought they were very illuminating about a documentary that I think a lot of us are invested in. And I want to thank Dan Weatherspoon for kicking me in the butt to get me here to do this. I sometimes think, who goes to Sunstone anymore? And then I think, yeah, I do. So I'm glad we're all here. I have had a personal experience of being interviewed by Helen Whitney for this documentary for 2 hours in the freezing cold Devereaux Mansion in February. And it was really an interesting experience. I've never been that close to filmmaking and from the production end. And I found that it was... She put me right at ease, and now I know what those people are doing when they're talking into the camera like that. They're literally knee-to-knee with the interviewer, as I was, which was a little unsettling at first, but I got over it. And in the end, it was very, I didn't tell Helen this, but it was very cathartic for me. And so thank you for that. Overall, I felt that I enjoyed this film for a number of reasons. I loved the fact that for the first time I was seeing a documentary about my faith community that was not using institutional art. I loved the fact that she was using abstract and representational art like Trevor Southey, which I can get into. I can't get into that, the kind of art that you get assaulted by when you walk into the visitor center here. So thank you just for doing that one thing. It gave it a heft and an integrity and opened up a space for us to enter that highly representational art sucks the blood out of otherwise. I felt that it was very skillfully filmed, the deft voice montages at the beginning of certain sections where you get a kind of a stacking up of different voices and then more detail later. I thought that was very important in a very long film to get that kind of pause and preface to what was happening. I love the dreamy, thoughtful images. I love the silhouette of the horseman riding off with Richard Bushman's voice in the background talking about the dark moments for Joseph Smith and Kirtland. And I thought, you know, yeah, we could have had the talking head, or we could have had another awful picture of Joseph Smith. Institutional art is what I'm talking about. But we didn't. We got something that was interpretive but was not hitting you over the head. So that was a blessed relief. And also I felt that overall, this 4 hours, that there was really a good sampling of the brief and the protracted moments. She knew how to give it texture by focusing very briefly on some things while giving a lot of time to other segments. So you got a sense of some kind of terrain. And definitely those were her choices that were artistic and very showed her craftsmanship. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the content. The shadow side of faith was brought up in the beginning of the film, and I didn't really feel that it was voiced in those terms later, and I was disappointed by that, or explored, other than as a series of recounted tensions between different factions, for example, authority versus the intellectual inquiry, sexual orientation versus family imperatives, faith-promoting history versus the new Mormon history. We kind of fell into this back-and-forth thing, but it wasn't in the context, strongly enough in the context, of how does a faith community face its shadow side in the end. I wanted more of that, because that's my issue. So it's probably very personal. I felt the exception to that was the chapter on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and like Anne, I felt that it was completely justified to have a half an hour episode on that. For one thing, I thought it was a fabulous case study of our community's chronic inability to face our own, to face ourselves squarely as participants in our own unhappiness and in our, quite frankly, our own persecution. It's a terrific case study of that. It happens in microcosm, in the ward house, and in families all the time. So, and it was dramatic. How could a filmmaker not touch that and use that? By way of critique, I felt that as a cultural artifact, that this is going to be a tremendous resource of artful and respectful shaping of the Mormon phenomenon to date. I felt that the filmmaker saw Mormonism as the subject rather than the target of her art and craft, and that is definitely to be commended. This phenomenon of Mormonism is much bigger than any of the participants in the film, including the filmmaker. And the folly, as I saw on screen and in the filmmaker, is an assumption that especially the academics being interviewed had they felt that there was an assumption there that they could wrap their mind around the whole enchilada and that they could present the definitive assessment of the phenomenon. And I don't know if that's a fair assessment of Helen, but I felt that that might have been there and that it kind of derailed some of the thrust of the film. I sensed that there was an assumption to begin with that the filmmaker was going to get to the bottom of this, demystify and normalize Mormons for everyone, including Mormons themselves. I think that this stance toward the material may have skewed some of the questions she and her writer asked, and constrained rather than enabled an open-ended investigation. For example, I was aware in my interview that the first question out of the gate, if I remember correctly, was, do you believe in Joseph Smith's claims? Or how do you believe in Joseph Smith? Is it a literal belief or what? Are you a believer in that sense? And that was, I felt that that brought into a kind of, that brought, she had brought into a kind of Mormon continental divide right away, in which immediately everyone would either flow toward the Mississippi or flow toward the Colorado River, depending upon their answer. And I think that, you know, phrasing the questions, as a good documentarian knows, that's perhaps 50% of it. Maybe I shouldn't say that, I'm not a documentarian, but anyway, that was a concern of mine. Finally, and this returns us to the intriguing notion, I think, of the shadow side of a religion, I felt that the filmmaker missed an opportunity. In her attempts to normalize Mormonism and position it as part of the pantheon of world religions, I felt like she forgot to critique the world of religion through Mormonism. Instead of contrasting us with other faith communities and religious movements, perhaps she could have done more comparing. Watching the film, what astonished me about my own Mormon ethnicity was the same thing that would astonish, I think, a Catholic, a Muslim, an evangelical Christian, or Jew about their own faith. The power, the ecstasy, the sense of safety, the sense of communal freight, the power of a story. But what creeped me out about my own faith is the same that would creep out a Catholic, a Muslim, an evangelical Christian, or a Jew. The violence, the control, the self-justification, the exclusivity, and the sense of hopeless entrapment. Perhaps it's easier or fits better the filmmakers and our own self-image as sensitive, inclusive sorts not to address the nature of religion as a whole, but in this world of fundamentalisms and fascisms, it's an issue we must face directly, putting aside so-called correct sensibilities. As with any outing of this type, Helen Whitney's The Mormons is both constrained and enabled by her choices. Again, my own feeling is that there can never be a definitive anything, whether it's a Mormon film, a Mormon novel, a Mormon study, or a book of scripture explaining the origins of the American Indian. But these texts can be instructive, inspiring, and moving as much for what they seem to accomplish as for what they fail to reveal. So, thank you.
I'd like to thank our panelists for beginning this conversation, I think, in really great ways from very, very different perspectives. I just have to take advantage of the mic for just a second, too, and say that as someone who's done a lot of writing on Mormon women and Mormon history, too, I was more interested in part two than I was part one. I started to watch it when I was really tired, and I remember falling asleep in part one, and I thought I need to go back to that. But I think as someone who's been in the Mormon faith, I was like, yes, yes, I remember Mountain Meadows. Now get to the controversy. Get to the good stuff, which to me was in part two and that I love. And also as someone who has worked with academics to shape courses in Mormon studies, although I have not taught one myself, I work with a colleague at Arizona State University. I have had the opportunity and probably will in the future to teach courses on Mormons. I think that the resource is wonderful, and that the fact that it's available on the internet in snippets too, as a teacher, that I just salivate all over that, right? So that there are these, to me, it's a great opportunity to take it in bits and bites and as springboards for conversations in courses. I think it's going to be invaluable in that way. And I want to say that I was especially moved too by the segment on the Katrina disaster, and I started to tear up when he said, you know, a Mormon will be welcome in my house. I myself consider myself post-Mormon. I'm a hybrid, come from both a Mormon and non-Mormon background. My father was not Mormon, and I'm no longer practicing. But I do feel sometimes an impulse to defend Mormons still. And I loved the fact that someone said, you know, when a Mormon comes to my door now, I might have turned them away. Those missionaries were somehow unknown to me. But they will have a place in my house. And I think that certainly any Mormons who felt defensive about the documentary had to have felt positively about those comments, and that was heartening to me as a post-Mormon. That is, to me, one of the best things about my faith community is how Mormons really do respond to people in very human and humane ways, and they even have these mechanisms set up that are quite astounding to respond to human disasters, their own and other people, and that ultimately, although they're often seen as a cliquish group, they respond in humane ways when it comes to the human condition in that regard. So I was really proud to be a Mormon at that moment in the documentary, even though there were moments of horrifying moments as well. And so that was some of my initial response. I just had to get that in a little bit. And now what I'd like to do is ask you to come to the microphone and ask any of the panelists to expound a little bit more on what they had to say and or make comments yourself. And I hope at some point that Helen may be interested and would like to comment as well. So we'll just begin and see where this goes. I think we have someone here right now.
As a landowner, I too thought it was a well-balanced presentation, and I've enjoyed it very much, and I agree with Anne that Dolan Oaks did a very beautiful job of coming very close to dealing with the Mountain Massacre. But one of the things that Dolan Oaks said that bothered me as a non-Mormon, who is part of the progressive tradition of question everything, is he said in that documentary that even when the authorities are wrong, you have to agree with them. And that kind of bothered me. I wonder if anybody else caught that.
Yes.
I would like to say that that's actually...
I do want to say that's not quite what he said. What he said was that it is wrong to criticize your leaders even when you disagree with them, which is not the same as you have to agree with them even when they're wrong. And I know it really isn't. I've talked about this in another place before, and maybe this is just my own tiny mind bending around that. I am allowed to say that I disagree with Russell Nelson's stance on the need for a same-sex marriage amendment. I'm allowed to say that I disagree with that, that I think it's wrong. What I'm not allowed to say is that Russell Nelson is an idiot, and how can he say something like that? That's just so stupid. It's so obviously wrong. And that's the way I took that. I realized that that was just a snip of a piece of his interview, and like I said, this may be just my way of wrapping my mind around what he said, but I really did take that as, first of all, nothing new. You know, you're not supposed to be publicly say critical things about your leaders, and the other piece of it is that doesn't mean we're not allowed to disagree with their policies or their statements. And if I'm wrong about that, I'm sure I'll find out.
My name is Paul Toscano, and my wife wanted to be here. She was in the second segment on dissidents, and she wanted to be here and apologizes for not being here because she's either chairing or moderating a concurrent session. But she wanted me to convey two points to the audience, to the panel, that to be clear about. When she was giving her explanation of her excommunication, Helen had B-roll, I guess is what it's called, or visuals that were presented while Margaret was talking, that showed the arrangement of the excommunication room. The chairs were in a semicircle, and she had a lone chair that was facing 12 chairs, and then off to the side there was a table, I think. And that was actually how she was excommunicated, in a room, not the high council room. There was no table, and she was there was no table in front of her, so she had to sit with her knees together in Mayan-made fashion, as girls are taught, I guess, and she had to keep shifting back and forth between the council of the high council and the stake president, who was acting more as a prosecutor, from a table to the side. So that was accurate. It may not be how it ordinarily happens, but it was accurate in this case. And she wanted to make that clear, because after the airing of this in April, a lot of people complained rather stridently that this couldn't have been true, but it was. The second thing they complained about was the fact that she was 1 against 16. And that, even though the Doctrine and Covenant sets up a bunch of procedures about how excommunication trials are to be conducted, those procedures were not followed in my excommunication, nor in hers. The council, it was discussed about dividing, but no one divided. They sat that way, and the only defense that was made for Margaret was that she should be excommunicated because she broke the letter of the law, although she was a very nice person. That was the height of the defense that was made on her behalf. She was not allowed to argue in her defense. She was not allowed to question. She was only allowed to answer their questions that were proposed to her, and she did that. That was what she wanted me to clarify. What I want to say is that in the host of blogging that has gone on the internet and certain emails that I'm aware of where strident implications were made that this was factually inaccurate, there was a statement made years ago by C.S. Lewis that it was easier to explain why a person is wrong than to prove that they are. And the one thing we should not do is launch into a discussion about why people are wrong and their motivations until we have first at least established that they are wrong. And it's a tendency that we have to jump to conclusions. So, with that said, I hope that the record is clear.
One thing I noticed about the documentary is that theology was so minimal. And I know this is difficult because in Mormonism, it is huge. It's important to Mormons. It does impact how Mormons live and think and feel and the way they relate to each other. Yet Mormons seem to be very indifferent to theology in many ways. And you can still be a Mormon and believe just about anything you want. It's just as long as you're not raising a stink. Just as long as you're not publicly disrespecting, you know, the authority structure. So I don't know. Is that you think that says that lack of theology in the documentary? Does that say more about Helen and maybe her value system that she's bringing to the documentary, or does that say more about Mormonism itself?
Yeah, it says a lot. I think it's terribly difficult to get into serious discussion of any theological perspective in this type of documentary. Almost by implication, it would create polarizing tendencies to shut down people's brains. I would have liked to have seen more theology. I was hoping to see more of that myself. That was one of my disappointments as well. But I see why she did it, and I think probably it was better in terms of her objectives, but maybe she can speak to that at some point herself.
I'm rather new to this, so I hope I don't do anything wrong. I know, yeah. I just like to say that the parts that I think the part of the documentary that touched me the most was the part where they discussed the relief work to the Gulf Coast, because up until June of this year, I used to live in Atlanta, in Lawrenceville, actually, and I had three opportunities to go to New Orleans and to Mississippi to do relief work. We went down there, just after the hurricane hit. I think it was just 2 weeks after, and it was literally unlike anything that I had ever experienced before. I think what it reminded me the most of was when I was a child, watching images of Beirut on CNN. I mean, it was literally unlike anything that I had experienced before, and I guess the one thing that made me proud to be a Mormon through watching the documentary, and I'm a rather conservative Latter-day Saint, and I'd say that I loved the whole thing. I thought it was excellent. But the one thing that I liked was that it emphasized that in Mormonism you create this sense of community that I have a hard time finding any place else. And I've tried to find this community in other places. And I think that was one thing that Helen did very well, was that she communicated this sense of community that Mormonism creates, where you're able to bring together from different political, social, educational areas, and you're able to bind them together, even though, you know, they might believe very different things. I think, in a way, it helps us put aside some very superficial things and lets us lets us get down to the to what we basically need to be doing, which I feel the essence of all religions should basically be, you know, who is God and what is my responsibility to my fellow man in relationship to that. And that's just all that I'd like to say. Thank you.
You mentioned, Dr. Foster, the hatred of Mormons in their early history. And I hope I'm quoting the right book. I think it was The Culture of Disbelief by the attorney Stephen Carter, where he talks about them being the only group that we had federal permission to persecute. It was actually federally written into law because they were, and I quote, subversive of good order. And I didn't know what that meant. So I trusted him when he said what it means is that we were allowed to persecute them because they existed far enough outside the social norms with, I assume, polygamy, that they made other people behave badly. So we didn't persecute them for their own bad behavior, but they made the rest of us act badly because they were a little beyond our borders of behavior. So we were allowed to have open season on them. There's some discussion, or it appeared to me, that what you were saying as a panel was that your assumption is that part of Helen Whitney's agenda was to undermine prejudicial thinking. So I will assume there's still some hatred around. How do we account for it today? Are we still behaving badly? I'm a non-Mormon. Am I still behaving badly?
One of the hardest things any group has to do is to be honest in realizing its own feet of clay. And that's true in every group. And there are mistakes made in every group. And sometimes they're made because of policy. And you don't get the whole story. Anytime I look at an account or hear an account of the persecution in Missouri, for example, I always look to see, and the extermination order, Governor Boggs, I look to see if there's any discussion of what preceded that. Rarely is there. Sidney Rigdon, in a public speech that sometimes called the Salt Sermon, made an extremely stupid, I won't say idiotic, but extremely stupid statement, saying it would be as a war of extermination, he used the word, of us against them, something to that effect. That preceded Boggs' statement. The problem was, Rigdon didn't have the ability to do it, but Boggs did. That type of, even if it's only verbal, excess, and I think it was probably expressed, it's always two-sided. There's always, both sides are somewhat responsible and guilty. But if you're going to try to calm those difficulties, I think one has to go maybe a little more than halfway. And I think that's what the Mormon Church is trying to do right now. The other thing is, I probably shouldn't say this, but I get very bored with the discussion of whether Mormons are Christian or not. All we need to do is put in one qualifier, and we could probably put this utopian to rest. Mormons are not Orthodox Christians. There is no way, if you know much about Orthodox Christianity, that Mormons are Orthodox Christians. But that does not mean that they're not Christians or that they're not right. I mean, how do you know that Orthodox Christianity is right? I mean, Mormonism got started by attacking the existing churches as being wrong. Now, what did they? Now they want to sort of, we want to have it both ways. You know, we're the only true church, but you should let us also be one of you. It doesn't quite work. So there are these inconsistencies, and you know, I don't think one has to take a stand on one thing or the other. But it seems like it's nice if people can at least realize that there are these inconsistencies, and that a lot, you know, if the Tanners feel like they're dumped on by the Mormons
field up done by the Tanners, and you get this cycle of, you know, like a dysfunctional marriage or whatever, you know, or a dysfunctional divorce, I should say more. But, you know, this sort of stuff. So yeah, there are reasons for all of these things.
Like Anne, I was much more interested in Mormon's reaction to the film than the film itself. And when it was shown in April, it was shown Monday and Tuesday, and Tuesday night, I hadn't watched any of it. I DVR'd it because I DVR everything. And I went to Portland Mormon Choir rehearsal. And I already feel a little bit like a fish out of water at Portland Mormon Choir because they're just regular Mormons. They're just regular Mormons. And at the very beginning, before anything else happened at the rehearsal, the director asked, how many people here watched the documentary last night? And probably 80 to 100 people raised their hands. How many people liked it? And close to 90% of those put their hands down. And I was like, wow. You know, I didn't expect that kind of reaction. And then, you know, he said, I mean, there was a very, the tone of his whole, you know, his demeanor was just very, like, we're so persecuted. And he said, well, let's sing. Let us sing to remind us why we're all here. Oh, how lovely was the morning. And and I hadn't watched it, so I'm like, what on earth? So, but then when I watched it, I was like, I still have no idea what they were talking about. But I, the more I talked to these regular Mormon people in my ward, in the Portland Mormon Choir, I'd ask them, you know, what was it that you found so troubling? What was so offensive about it? And I think it comes down to the labeling issue, where when they didn't know where someone was coming from, they didn't know their background, they didn't know where they stood on the spectrum, they had to just go whether they recognized their names or not. And most of these people only recognize the names of the general authorities. So everyone else who was talked to, who was quoted, was an anti. And they also had, Mormons are so used to getting just institutional history and institutional art and institutional everything, and they're used to hearing it in a certain voice that's hagiographic or borderline hagiographic. They don't understand a neutral tone. So even if something is, on balance, neutral, they don't perceive it as such because, you know, they don't recognize, they assume as an anti-Mormon. Or if they don't, they have to go by other cues. So Dan Peterson, because he talked about peepstones in a hat, oh, anti-Mormon. Or Kathleen Flake, because she referred to Smith instead of Joseph Smith or the Prophet Joseph or whatever, anti-Mormon. You know, which had nothing to do with anything. I go by these other weird little markers. So I did a little bit of damage control. The people on my ward, it's like, oh, anti-Mormon. I'm like, well, actually, he's a farms guy. He could not possibly be more, you know, conservative apologist. And I think, oh, Helen, I was going to say, I hope Dan Peterson sent you roses. Because he came across as so sympathetic in the documentary, and so charismatic and charming and nice, and anybody who's read his writings online or in print is like, is this the same person? So I hope he gave you props for that.
I just wanted to say two things in response to that. First of all, Mormons love being persecuted. We live for being persecuted. I spent 5 years in Lubbock, Texas, and if we didn't have two or three testimonies about how oppressed we were, it was not a normal Fast Sunday. And the other thing I wanted to... oh, darn. Is it gone? Oh, the other thing I wanted to talk about was, I think that, Ms. Peterson, is that your name? Yeah, okay. The other thing that I think contrasts with my experience and yours is that I heard not one word about that, about the documentary overtly in my own ward. Now, admittedly, I'm kind of antisocial, but, I thought that was really interesting in that the next Sunday was Fast Sunday, and there were at least 5 or 6 testimonies that came up that Sunday that explicitly said, I don't just believe, I know. And, oh, I mean, I blogged about it, how nuts it made me. But I when I wrote about that, I actually got a number of responses that probably, because I didn't connect the two, but that probably was a response to people having seen the documentary, even though they didn't talk about it explicitly.
Just one other quick comparison, the Jewish comparison. I was at a conference on interreligious hostility back in the middle 80s, run by a Jewish rabbi, and he commented to me during the course of that conference that they had just word had just come out recently that the Jews had the highest per capita income of any religious group in the United States, and it was an immediate effort to shut down this information from going out and being publicized, and they'd much rather be seen as Holocaust victims and persecuted and so forth. So, you know, it's not just Mormons.
One of the things that struck me was during the Apostle interviews where Dallin Oaks made the statement about it's wrong to criticize the leaders of the church, the distinct lack of strength he projected when he said that. His facial expression almost looked like he knew it wouldn't fly outside of a Mormon audience. Similarly, Elder Packer, when he was asked about a statement that I don't know what the question was coming to him, but he said, did I really say that? Again, he projected a lack of strength. I mean, I remember he looked down, no eye contact. And what it showed to me is how when those people are outside of their power realm, they present so much differently because there's a level playing field in the interview. And General Conference, BYU addresses are quite different. I was wondering, my question is, did anybody else pick up on that?
Yes.
Yeah, now that you mention it, yeah. I'm trying to think if I can say anything intelligent in response to that, but I felt that the authorities came across. I think one of the advantages of this documentary is that it does flatten the playing field to some degree, and I think that's very valuable, and to the credit of the institutional church, they were on board with that. I think mostly because their hands have been forced, though. And because they know that if they do try to control something like this, then it'll just make them look very bad. Like the Denver Post article back in the 80s, if you remember that. But to me, I felt that... actually, that's all I have to say. There's other people...
Did Brother Packer own up? He said he didn't remember...
He says if it was published and they said I said it, then I said it. And I thought that was the first time I saw that, I felt that it was a little disingenuous. But then I thought, well, you know, he doesn't come to Sunstone. He's not in the teapot where the tempest is, and quite frankly, he doesn't give a crap. And maybe that's a good thing for him. He's out there fighting dragons throughout the world. What does he care about homosexuals, feminists, and... What were they? Intellectual. Oh, yeah.
I'm going to make this very quick, but in my book, Faithful Transgressions in the American West, I talk about authority issues and how women gain credibility within this religious faith. And I think that it's interesting. We look to, for women to speak, they don't have the same kind of credibility and authority. They never have priesthood authority to speak, and therefore, whatever I say to you right now, I wouldn't have if I was in a church meeting, the same kind of credibility or authority to speak. And that's what we saw in Mormon's angst, and I have to tell you, I have a little angst of not knowing what the credibility or authority of who this person is speaking, because as both an academic and a Mormon, I'm looking at what are the credentials of this person? How is this person legitimate? How do I get legitimacy? How do I know who you are based on your background, your education, and within Mormonism, are you a priesthood authority? And so it's really interesting to me. I was noticing that the general authorities of the leaders, and it has to do with who your audience is and how you gain credibility and authority. One of the things in my book, I had to make a decision about whether I would let them know, whether I would let my audience know whether I was a practicing Mormon or not, because that gained you credibility and authority within this
community also. How Mormon are you? Are you a regular Mormon? Are you Orthodox? Are you liberal? And this terminology that I use now, post-Mormon rather than anti or ex-Mormon, there's this constant dance trying to gain credibility so that people believe you, listen to what you have to say. A documentary filmmaker has to think about those issues, and those are core to our belief system, is where do you gain authority to speak? And we often refer to scripture, you know, always referring to this scripture backs me up, or my education backs me up because I'm here. So that's the rhetoric, that's the rhetorical dance always going on. And I also wanted to say, we're here until 12:45. I'm really interested in getting as many comments as possible, and then hoping, Helen, would you be willing to make just a few comments maybe in the last 5 minutes? If we can, that would be really great. And so as many people as possible, I would like to get here to the microphone. And Anne is going to make one quick comment, and then we're going to go on.
I just wanted to say that I do think about the power level in the context of those two statements, both by Elder Oaks and by Elder Packer, I think it is really interesting that the church has tried to, in my opinion, recover their power in those statements by publishing on the LDS.org website the full interviews from which their statements were taken. And I really do see that as an effort to recover the power of these gentlemen for the what is perceived as unflattering remarks or remarks that they do not come across well in those statements. And by publishing the full statements, I think the church is attempting to say to recover their power among the Latter-day Saints.
When Laura stood up, I thought, I'm going to faint because this line was so long and I am so scared. And then when you stood up, I thought, I've got it. Okay, Lord, give me strength. Okay. First of all, I want to give my credentials. I am a former Mormon who was called to be an Episcopal priest. I'm at All Saints Episcopal Church in Salt Lake City. I am so thankful for Helen's documentary. I reiterate what Laura has said in terms of teaching. Because I didn't really leave the Mormon church. I was called to the Episcopal church. I called myself a Mormon Episcopal priest. And I'm very clear about that. In the book I've written, I name myself that. And I feel very strongly that my call is to somehow be engaged in reconciliation and understanding in our society. I've been involved in the Bridges program in Salt Lake. I'm also a spiritual director, and I deal with an amazing number of angry, disenchanted Mormons. And what I see in this film is a wonderful way of talking to people who need to vent, because there is, as far as I know, there's no place when you leave or you are kicked out or whatever to vent your anger, and so it just goes all over every place, anyone who will listen. And that is the role I try to play with them, is to give them a place where they can look at their anger. What this film does for me is give me something that is objective to raise them beyond their own personal hurt and story, so that we can talk about issues and help them to realize that the things that they are painfully, painfully struggling with are recognized by someone. That means so much that somebody understands you. And so to see it in the film, to see these faces and to hear the shadow side of Mormonism is pure gold. And I just thank you, Helen. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
I don't have any credentials. I have a label, though, Pam. I'm David's wife, so I'm married into the community. I'm Episcopalian. We call ourselves Episcomos. But I'm still wondering whether the prejudice that injured the community so early in American history is alive and well. And if it is not, then what is the panel's opinion of the filmmaker's agenda? Sure. You want that one more time? Okay, just for you. I wonder if prejudice, anti-Mormonism, either within the Mormon community, which is where you hear it at its worst, from former Mormons or disenchanted Mormons, you hear the worst things from the Mormons themselves. But is anti-Mormonism still alive and well as it once was, when it shaped the community in early American history? And if that prejudicial barrier doesn't exist anymore, if we're all mainstream now, then why, how do you account for this filmmaker's artistic choice? What would you describe as her agenda, in your opinion?
I don't think there's any question that prejudice against Mormons is still alive and well. I, as someone who has considered having a career in Mormon studies and has been at various moments warned against doing such a thing, and I actually have, in one sense, weeded myself out of that career fully. There is prejudice within the academy, certainly, against doing this, but one of the ways that I've been trying to promote Mormon studies and promote courses on Mormonism, at Arizona State University we have a healthy religious studies department, and we also have a center for the conflict resolution, because we're aware very much how religion is impacting human interrelations today, and yet getting a Mormon studies course has been a challenge. And but by doing so, we gain legitimacy of the religious group, and they don't just become some kind of weird, odd something. It legitimizes Mormonism and the study of Mormonism and my own research and publishing in it. So I'm actually an advocate of it. But the difficulty of that just gives evidence to me that there certainly is prejudice and Mormons' own defensiveness about it. My own trying to pass as a non-Mormon for many years are in different, you know, when and where I reveal my social positions and my history. I still am very hesitant to tell people that I got my bachelor's and my master's degree at Brigham Young University, because I know from an outsider's perspective how that may land for outsiders. That has to be clear evidence that there's still prejudice about Mormonism. I don't think there's any question about that. But I think that the film itself is encouraging because it gives us, it enriches and makes it a more complex question for outsiders. That's what we wish for, I think, in many ways, or those of us who have really thought about Mormonism. We want people to see us as diverse. We are not just whatever it means to be regular or orthodox Mormons. We're actually very complicated and complex. I don't know of very many people who I might even call orthodox, even though some of us may like to think of ourselves. If you look at any Mormon family, they are not what even we may think of as that story. And this film complicates Mormonism for both insiders and outsiders, and I think that's the benefit and the contribution of the film at this historical moment.
I think Dave raises an interesting point that it's hard for us insiders to recognize in terms of how we perceive ourselves and perceive the film. But I think it's important to remember, we are not like other religions. We are not one of many religions. I don't think you could have made a similar kind of documentary about Methodists or Lutherans. And I don't mean any disrespect for them by saying that. I just mean our complex social structure and theology dictates that we are unique among all religions. I mean, like, how many religions have officially believed in life on other planets for the last 180 years? I don't know of any that officially believe as part of their scripture, or that believe that God has sex. And I could go on with a lot of other things. You know, the notion that man and God can be the same is probably what got Joseph Smith killed, and it drives other people crazy about our theology. And as well as our unique social structure, and I would guess that the Jewish culture is the closest one that comes to that in terms of their tight-knit connectedness. Where was I? I lost my train of thought. I was going to ask you. Sorry. This is leading up to what I think is. Oh, okay. In listening to your comments and my own knowledge of my culture, we want to believe that our culture and our religion is one neat package and one whole, and it's always been the same and never changed. And our perception of that and what we're taught is that that's what it is. There's one story and there's one narrative. And the implication of a documentary is that you can explore something and then reveal this is what it is. And I think what Helen has done is very pointedly shown that you cannot know this culture. You can know many aspects of it. You can see and observe many people and their responses to it and touch on its theology and see how our perceptions have changed over the last 150 years. But you cannot know it. And I think that is what ultimately respects our history better than trying to pin it down and saying, this is what it was or is. I don't think you can know. And I think that's ultimately what disturbs Mormons the most, is because we want to believe we can know, and that we have a clear narrative. And the documentary, I think, accurately shows that you cannot know it. At best, you can observe it and see how it's changing. And for me personally, I think that's one of the most beautiful, attractive things about our religion, and especially about Joseph Smith, is the complexity of his character, and that we see how God works through human beings, through a very complex, powerful yet flawed person, which is not what we officially want to believe and see about ourselves. And I think the documentary undermines that, you know, I think in a good way, but not what we want to expect from ourselves.
I'd like to make just two quick comments. Observations from interactions with people in talking about this documentary. I was home teaching a few weeks ago, and one of the fellows that we visited was just full of wrath and fury and felt that the documentary was a trashing of Mormonism. I would keep trying to respond to his statements, but he was so full of fury that I could hardly get a word in edgewise, and finally I just let him vent his spleen, and I'm going to talk with his wife a little bit later about a few things. I just couldn't get a word in edgewise. What I did want to tell him, though, was something that happened the morning after the second night of this program presentation. Two of my former friends from work, I'm now retired, but two friends called me. One of them was an evangelical born-again Christian. He made a very astounding statement to me. He said, I am frankly appalled by your religion, so I have been asking myself now for several decades why it is that I like all of you people. And he said, after seeing that documentary last night, I know. And that's something that I want to direct specifically to Helen.
So Helen, can we ask you just to come here and just give your response to our reviews and any other thing you might like to mention? I'm also curious, as you're walking up here, how the decision was made to make it available on the internet, in those snippets and that process that PBS goes through.
Okay. Hi. Well, I was delighted by much that was said, and I thought a lot was very perceptive, and I just have a few comments. Some of them housekeeping details of things that I think are sort of wrong or just a little bit off, and responding to one of the more serious questions that I think is fair. But anyway, just in response, because I was going to say it anyway, the decision to put the interviews on was ours. We, since the internet and our website has become available, I'm always trying to get the most interesting interviews out there in their entirety. So that was not the church's decision. They may have taken them. I haven't really looked at their website, but it was our decision, not the church's, to make themselves look better, to put them on. So that's just a tiny, small thing. And also another very small thing, which Albert said I shouldn't comment on, but I am anyway. It's hard for me to imagine, David, that I would ever ask a question like you said I did, because I would be the only person out of, 200 interviews I did. I always asked everybody, their particular take on Joseph, but I would use words like, paint a portrait of him for me. Talk to me about his contradictions. Talk to me about his complexity. That's how I would always start out, because I do think he is the alpha and omega, of this religion, and I certainly have gotten those criticisms that you mentioned, and your support of them was elegant and eloquent of that particular criticism. Another thing, the Dallin Oaks quote, and this one I'll have to disagree with you. I don't have the quote in front of me, but I know it came from published texts of his, in which he says many times to the effect of, it's wrong to criticize, what is it, Albert? It's wrong to criticize the authorities. It's not wrong to criticize church figures, even if the criticism is correct. Even if the criticism is true. And it's shocking and startling, it was to both Mormons and non-Mormons, but I'll say in Dallin Oaks's sort of, the credit I give him is that he owned that. He did not say, well, that was then, this is now, and I really, there's some subtlety and nuance in that I would like to explain. He just owned it. And I felt a great deal of respect for him for doing so. Regarding the question raised, which is a fair one, about was there enough theology in the film? Now, I think it was Larry who said, and it's true, filmmakers have a real problem in really, talking about these abstract ideas and not turning people off and turning them into a theology lesson. We can never do what a book does or an article does or what a sermon does. Just, it's not what we do best, and I think if most of you were here last night when I was talking about the special challenges of making films about spiritual subjects, that's one of them. But at the same time, during that 4 hours, I felt there were, I did sort of circle and tease out some of the bigger, bolder ideas of Mormonism, to wit, the man-God idea. Terrell Givens talks about that. I also talked about polygamy, not I personally, but people, as a central defining doctrine of Mormonism in the 19th century, that it was essential to salvation, that was as important to Mormons in the 19th century as baptism is for mainstream Christians. Other theological ideas. Terrell Givens once again talks quite clearly about what he thinks is the unique Mormon heresy, which is the collapse of sacred distance between man and God, and why that really is unique in Mormonism, and the collapsing of distance, the literalness of the Mormon faith, and the idea that God is embodied, has a body. This is no small thing in Mormonism. The plates are real and all of that. So there's a lot of time spent on that as well. In the Family Act, another very core idea is family is eternal. No small thing. And that gender is eternal. We talk about the proclamation of the family. And there, there's a number of ideas, and I had to be selective that we did focus on, but not all at once. I tried to sort of let people absorb these new ideas and then come back to them. And also, the whole act was called Revelation, and the importance of Revelation to Joseph and to the church then and to the church now. Anyway, that's probably a longer answer than I should. There was something that was said about this religion is not. This religion is unique. Who is it that there was? All right. You know, I think I did spend some... maybe it's subject for a longer conversation, but I don't... I think there are big, bold ideas in Mormonism, but there are big, bold ideas in other religions. And I did, one of the ways I would deflect a lot of the criticism and the laughter and the satirical edge of people who would be coming up to me at parties and saying, I can't believe that you're making a film about the Mormons. I mean, they believe in golden plates, they believe in this. And I would say, have you looked at your own religion lately? Have you looked at the central animating ideas, the foundational stories, burning bushes, a Jewish teenager giving birth to God without sexual intercourse? I mean, that's pretty big. Lazarus rising. I mean, you know, I mean, you Mormons don't have a corner on it, you know, but I think what they do have, and again, that's a terrible idea, you know, so many religions today are moving delicately towards metaphor, and the Mormons are not. And it's the shocking literalness of the Mormons. And if you sort of parse out the ideas of heaven, even in evangelicals, everyone is quite fuzzy on that subject, except for the Mormons. Unlike almost any religion in the 20th century, the Mormons are yet more specific and yet more concrete about the look and feel of heaven. What else? Someone asked me whether I had an agenda, and I guess it's a word that I just, I don't have an agenda. And obviously if I felt that this film, by complicating the picture, as you elegantly put it, shatters stereotypes, so be it. But I set out to paint a portrait, a thematic portrait, not a chronological one, of a religion which fascinates me, and I think attention has not been paid to it. And, broadly speaking, that was my agenda. And I think the most serious criticism, and it's a fair one, is one that David made, about did I spend enough time on what was promised at the opening, on looking at the shadow side of this religion, the shadow side of this religion and all religions. I think I did spend some time about the shadow side, that's unique to Mormonism, its reliance on authority that could have, murderous results, as was discussed in Mountain Meadows, and questions of authority and exclusivity and absolutism. And I think it was touched on in a leitmotif. It went through many of the acts and obviously was most focused on the act on dissenters and exiles. But in terms of absolutism, which is a very important subject, it's one I actually dealt with in great depth, I think, in my previous film, Faith and Doubt at Ground Zero, which is a film, if any of you haven't seen it, was about the aftershocks of 9/11. And in that film, I look at not only the face of evil, but I look at and meditate on that in relation to 9/11 and the face of God. I do talk about the face of religion and the lust for the absolute that is at the heart of all religions, not just Mormonism, not just Catholicism, and both the beauty that can come out of that, and so much does, and the kind of and the terror that can come out of it, and the violence that can come out of it, out of that kind of fundamentalism that is unchecked. So I did feel that I had such a job ahead of me, which is both painting this portrait of this religion, and showing what was peculiar and other about it, and honoring that distinctness, and also forcing people to see themselves in this religion. That was no small thing, how this religion is, parallels the history of Christianity. I felt that my job was just so difficult, getting getting there, that to go even further and say, now let's talk about absolutism and the darkness at the heart of this religion and others when it goes too far, I really felt that, it was too much on the plate. And I know there was something about prejudice that was asked, and I think I talked about that last night, about the ways in which fear primarily, the intensity of the fear that does linger about Mormons, but has changed radically since the 19th century, and yet endures. And I did talk about that last night, the ways in which I feel, yes, unintentionally, but the ways in which Mormons have given grist to that mill, you know, through their absolutist claims, through a kind of wearing the badge of persecution proudly, through not really owning up to what they believe, and on and on. I talked about that last night, the ways in which that fear that's so troubling and disturbing and unfair, but the ways in which Mormons do participate in that. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. Thank you, Helen, and thanks to the panelists for their contribution in beginning this conversation. Thank you.